Good afternoon, everyone. You're going to be hearing a different voice more this time than in the past, and I want to welcome everyone that's here today and welcome you to the October 2008 session of the International MD Support Group. As you may know, the guest today is someone that has enriched the lives of many people around the world who experience vision loss and their loved ones, and also enriched the lives of professionals who each day sit in front of a patient and hand-in-hand navigate the path that will lead to increased independence and knowledge. You all know this guest, our beloved Dan Roberts. Through an amazing series of events in Dan's life and through his ability to learn from the past, work in the present with a clear vision of the future, Dan has brought all of us and many more to come together. So today I have the honor to be in Dan's seat, and we are placing Dan in the seat of the presenter to allow all of us to hear from Dan and for us to know him better. Dan Roberts is a founder and director of the MD Support Incorporated, which includes mdsupport.org, the International MD Support Group, but it goes further than that. Many of you may know this, but he founded MD Support in 1995 as a result of his own need for support and information about central vision loss. Retired since 1995 from 23 years in public school education and 33 years in church music ministry, he now teaches at his own performing arts school, which he founded in 1984. In addition, he provides presentations about vision impairment for schools, community organizations, and support groups, and he instructs classes for the developmentally disabled at the University of Missouri at Kansas City and Longview Community College. He is the author of The First Year Age-Related Macular Degeneration Book, and is a consultant for pharmaceutical companies, lighting manufacturers, and dealers in protective eyewear. He is truly a scholar with the Roundtable Group Expert Services Firm and a member of the Low Vision Panel of the Society of Industrial Leaders, SIL, under the auspices of Standard & Poor's Vista Research. He is a member of the Low Vision Leadership Consortium and the Low Vision Rehabilitation Group. Dan Roberts is a graduate of the University of Missouri with a master's degree in education. He is a recipient of the 2004 Distinguished Service Award presented by the American Optometric Association Low Vision Rehab Section. This is the highest honor given by the Low Vision Rehab Section to an organization or individual for contributions to low vision care and distinguished service to the general welfare of the public. His organization was also awarded the National Eye Institute's 2006 Healthy Vision Community Award for innovative approaches to vision-related health education. Dan and Christina have been married since 1968. They have three children, and last I heard, four grandchildren. So as we go along here, I ask participants to submit questions and comments as we go along today that relates to our presentation or other questions that may be on your mind relating to vision. We will address these as we go along and by the end of today's session. Dan, you have no idea how I wish that others could know you as I do, and that is why I'm so excited to have the opportunity to present you to our listeners today. You have a wealth of knowledge, but certainly one of your many strengths is the ability to bridge research and professionals in the ophthalmic professions with those experiencing vision loss, either directly or indirectly. Dan, I guess the first time I had any experience with your work is with your outstanding book, Age-Related Macular Degeneration. You certainly have been a resource of information and knowledge for those with AMD. But what I wanted to know is, what was your biggest challenge in coping with AMD? And I wanted to really know why you do what you do.
I think probably I covered that on the first page of the newsletter this month. That is that when I was diagnosed, I had a disease that was going to rob me of my vision. There was nothing anyone can do about it. That was pretty traumatic. And I learned later that there was plenty that we could do about it. Unfortunately, my doctor did not know anything past the retina. And again, I don't blame the doctors for this. We have retinal specialists, and that's why they're called specialists, because that's what they do. They fix the retinas. That's what this man did. He wasn't there to fix me. And that's what I longed for. That's what I needed the most. And there wasn't anything available at that time for me. There wasn't anything available for most people. Since then, I think the person has become an important part of the continuum of care, not just the eyes. We are more than our eyes. That's a quote that I didn't make up. Don Fletcher, who we've had on here before, says that, and it's so true. There's a lot more to us. And that's what I felt the great need for when I was first diagnosed about 15 years ago, 14. And I went looking for the information, and then when I found it through the Internet, it was very difficult to find anywhere else. The Internet and I kind of grew up together, and as it grew, I found more and more information, and I'm kind of a collector. So I stored it all. I learned how to put together a website, and I stored it on the website in case anybody else wanted to find out about it. And that, to make a long story, a very long story, really short, unless it's too late, that's now 800 pages of information, collections of stories, research, studies, and things like that, and that's what we call the MD Support website. The International MD Support Group, which is what we're experiencing right now, is the main outreach of macular degeneration support, which became a nonprofit public service organization officially in around 1998. We actually were incorporated, and we are here to provide exactly what it was that I needed, and what everybody else I found needs too, and that's information and support for people who are affected by this disease and similar retinal diseases. And so It's a giant public awareness program. We've got a 13-member advisory board. We have over 4 million hits a year on our website. And we have now, as of today, Ed, and I think this is going to be news to you, we just got our 138th affiliate today. And that's probably 13 more than you thought we had, because we just sent out information around the country, about 20,000 flyers, and we've been getting three or four new affiliates every day joining us. So we're very happy that this is reaching over 2,500 people at this point, including the folks that are here today. So that is really where the need is now. People who are, there's about 65% of seniors now on the Internet. A small part of that group is low vision. That's a difficult group to get on the Internet for obvious reasons. And so we've decided to be nice and not just sit here on our Internet and keep this information to ourselves, but to try to get it out into the communities that don't have the resources and to the people that may not have the computers or the knowledge of computers. And our next step is going to be over the telephone, because now we realize there are also many, many people that are in the homes, in their own homes, and because they don't have transportation, or because they have disabilities that preclude them from leaving the house, they can't get to you and join your group. And so we're going to provide these same programs starting next year over the telephone in groups, in teleconferencing. We'll call it a telesupport group. So even if you become, people that are listening, become disabled or something to the point where you can't leave your home or your apartment, we will still be able to reach you and you'll be able to reach us in that way. So that's our third phase, and that's, we're really looking forward to that. And probably isn't our final phase. I just haven't thought of another phase to follow it yet. So our mission is simply to educate people and to help them educate themselves about their loss of vision and the daily challenges that result from it. And this kind of access will not cure retinal disease, but it's certainly going to help relieve the emotional trauma that often accompanies that disease. And so that was a long answer to a really short question. You might want to remind me, Ed, as to what the second part of that question was.
Oh, sure. No, that's great. You know, just as on a side note here, I think one of the things that really attracted me to the whole concept when I first learned of your work and vision is just the idea of bringing the technology and the information to people. For years, I've been dealing with low vision support groups at various locations and hospitals and clinics. And of course, it's very difficult to do that because people having difficulty getting out at certain times of the day and just the logistics of getting out to a support group. But this is certainly bringing the technology to the people. And I think your vision of being able to do that and the vision you have of of taking your past experience with teaching. You probably had no idea what you were actually preparing yourself for in the past, but that ability to teach and then see technology and see how you could plug those together and parlay it all into something that would help thousands, and really I'm sure it'll be millions of people through the years. But so really I guess my question was really answered in terms of why you do what you do and actually how you're doing and what your vision is in the future. But when did you actually feel like in that whole process when you learned you had macular degeneration, really when did you feel like, and what was that trigger that made you think you really had to get out and you wanted to get out and get the information to others?
There was a trigger. First of all, I was inspired in my entire life to have empathy for people with low vision because it was in my family. And so I was always around people with low vision. My who I called my Nana, my great-grandmother, had cataracts, and this was before surgery was available. And I stayed with her in the summer times, and I learned how to play canasta, and we used large print cards. And so I kind of grew up with that. I had another great-grandmother who was totally blind for whatever reasons, and she passed away when I was very young. But I still remember her and helping her around. And we don't know what her disease was. I had no idea that this was probably genetic. It was probably going to be passed down to me. My mother had some kind of a disease. She also had some cataract problems, but she died at the age of 59. She did have tunnel vision, and that would be retinitis pigmentosa probably. But again, she was never diagnosed, so... But again, I understood her conditions and that kind of thing. And I even, believe it or not, had a Cocker Spaniel for 12 years as I grew up. We grew up together. And Skippy passed away when we were both 12. And she was also blind in the very same eye that I'm, I don't say blind in, but the very same eye that I have no vision centrally. And so... by having pets and grandmothers and mothers and everything else, that's a pretty good motivation right there. The trigger was when to do what I do. And by the way, the reason I do what I do is because I have time to do it. First of all, I'm motivated, of course, because of my own personal experience, but I do have the time. I'm old enough now that I'm getting close to retirement. I did retire early because of my vision, but I was lucky enough to already have a performing arts school that I'd been running for several years before I quit school teaching, and that has been able to support me and my family. And so I've got time, also because I'm young. I'm only 62. I could be the son of many people that are listening here. And so I've got time in years, and I've got time in my days to do something about this. And I also had parents who instilled in me a sense of right and wrong, followed by a sense of justice, and we run into that. Sometimes we run into injustice, and some things that we encounter are just not right. And that, and of course the love of teaching, and that's probably a result of some deep psychological need to be needed. I'm not sure why. I like to just empty my brain every once in a while in front of people. My wife keeps telling me to just quit teaching for a while and relax, but I really feel good knowing that somebody's learning something, no matter whether I'm teaching or they're teaching each other. That's, I think, what we're all here for. And so the trigger, back to the trigger. That was that doctor. That initial doctor that told me that I was going to go blind, and that's the word he used. And there's nothing that anybody, he said nobody, can do anything about this. And I misinterpreted that, as many people do. I misinterpreted that as being they couldn't do anything about my visual condition or my psychological condition or me. They couldn't help me. And I left that office feeling totally lost, totally alone. And I have learned since then that there are many ways that I can be helped. And I just could not stand, picturing my grandmothers and my mother being in that same position. And I couldn't stand to think of anyone else in that same position. And if that information is there, then it should be gotten out. And so that was the trigger right there. It came from anger, actually. And I lost my anger when I started meeting the professionals in the field and the doctors and began to understand what they're saying when they say that. They just need to go one step further, and that's what we're working on right now with our outreach program. They need to go one step further and say, I can't help you, but here's somebody who can. and they're low vision rehabilitation specialists, and they can take you to the next step, low vision doctors. And so go on down the road. Here's how to go there, and here's where to go to find the information. If they would just take that extra little step, and we're trying to encourage them to do that by educating the patients to go to that doctor and actually ask the question, okay, I've been diagnosed. Now I know there's some place to go. I know what it is, but can you help me get there? So there's the trigger for it.
Oh, that's great, Dan. You just put it so well. I really love that idea of really making sure that the patient really asks what's the next step, because I've been saying that for years, and I'm constantly trying to educate, especially physicians, to make sure that when they say, listen, there's nothing more that I can do, meaning the physician can do, to at least say, but there are things that can be done. It's such a short, simple little sentence, but it will make all the difference in the world as to how a patient perceives what's being said and understands the future. So really now you've had 14 years since the diagnosis and really to process what the original diagnosis was and go through that whole series of ups and downs and the depression, and you really describe it as severe depression that led to the decision to retire early. So really now in retrospect, and certainly hindsight is 2020, so if you could really look back now with that 2020 hindsight and see how maybe things could have been handled different on your part. You mentioned a little bit how things could obviously be handled differently on the physician's part, but in particular, one area that I really find close to my heart, and that is how a person handles depression. How do you think maybe it could have been handled in yourself or by others, the depression that you experienced, and really maybe somebody that's being newly diagnosed with macular degeneration, how would you recommend that they handle maybe a depression that's being experienced?
Depression is definitely one of the worst symptoms of the disease. And everybody handles that in a different way, depending upon what I call their level of culpability, and we've had a whole session on that. But in general, when I speak to a group, I'll always ask them, I'll say, raise your hands if you went through any kind of depression for this, if you went through, because I sometimes think maybe I'm just a little weak, maybe that was a problem I had. But I have learned that 90% of people will answer, yes, I was scared. I was afraid of the monster behind the door. That's what I call it. And that is that's the challenge right there in coping with depression and AMD. We know through studies that depression is a big part of the disease, and we know how to handle depression. But I have found that the most effective way to handle it, and what I wish I had been able to do easier, was information. I needed information. I needed to get to know the monster, and then I wouldn't be as scared of it. They say knowledge is power, and that is absolutely true. When I was a child, I thought the monster behind the door was a gorilla. That was about the time that King Kong played on television, and the original version, so that's a few years ago. So that's what I pictured the monster. He wasn't too mean, though, at the time, because I was a child, and I trusted everything. But then when I became a young teen, it took on the shape of a man with a knife. That was scary. For some reason, this man was wanting to kill me in some terribly ugly fashion. He was always waiting outside my door, as far as I knew, and just ready to jump on me at any moment. I was a very dramatic 12-year-old. And that lasted a while. It was a very traumatic experience for me. And again, it's because I didn't know what was there, and I was afraid of that future. And then when I was 20, of course, as every 20-year-old does, it became totally invulnerable. Nothing can hurt me. I was healthy. I was cocky enough to think that I could live forever. So there was no monster behind my door then. I remember 10 years of freedom from that fear of the unknown, because I thought I knew it all. Then I was 40. And sure enough, the monster came back. I imagine it to be all those people who knew I was just bluffing, that I'd always been bluffing all my life, and those people were going to suddenly pop out and tell the whole world that I was just an idiot in disguise. And so that was my monster then, that I might get found out, that I really didn't know as much as I thought I did, and I really didn't know how to be a good parent. Then, on June 26th, I believe it was 1994, 1995, some doctor told me I'm going to go blind. There's nothing I can do about it, and that was the monster. That was the worst. That was the most unknown of the unknowns. He came out from behind the door. It was scarier than that gorilla was. It was scarier than that man with a knife. It was scarier than anything I could have imagined. And it was scary because I didn't know what to do about it, and nobody was there to give me any weapons. And I couldn't fight it. And that's what caused the depression. And I think many people will agree that the unknown is the worst aspect of this. And so resources, we've got to give people resources, even if they're not ready for them. I was not ready to go into rehabilitation when I was first diagnosed. I didn't want to admit even that I was going to lose my vision. I could see fine. I saw some distortion in one eye, and that's the only reason I went. But I didn't want to be told that I was going to become a blind person or even a person with low vision, one of those people that has to put a book up to his nose to read. I thought that has to be the worst thing in the entire world, and how embarrassing that would be for me to have to go through that. I had all these misconceptions about blindness that all came out of the fear and the ignorance that I had at the time. So this is what we need to hand people, and I mean hand it to them. Give it to them for free. Don't charge them for it. I give away more of my books than I sell because it's something that everybody just has to know. You've got to know this information, and that's going to help you deal with it. And then, of course, socialization is extremely important. You've got to have people, and that comes to the support groups. And so the two go hand in hand. You've got to have people to help you, because those, especially people that have been through it and know what you're going through. And so those are things that keep it going. Those are things that I think are important, and that's why we're all here.
That's right. I totally understand that. I was wondering, do you still have any challenges that you encounter and any struggles that you have, and how do you share those? And actually, how do you process those?
I still am afraid of the unknown. That's one reason I'm just possessed with the desire to learn more and more and talk to more and more people so that I don't ever go back to that situation I was in before. As far as challenges that I've got, I guess it's been turned around, because I did a total turnaround when I realized that my position now, when I learned that educating other people was maybe the reason I'm like this, the reason I've been given one good eye, one bad eye, because the Creator says, okay, let's give him a taste of how it feels, and then give him the ability on the other side of his body to be able to do something about it. And so my challenge now is not to take care of myself, because I already have done that. I feel totally ready for anything that might happen, because I know that not only is the technology there to help me, but the people are there to help me. There's thousands of people out there who understand, and I know that I can go to any one of them, and I hope everybody here feels the same way, that they can go to any one of us with a question or a problem. And also, I hope they go to us with information, because it's kind of like we're one big Wikipedia. If you don't know what that is, that's an interactive encyclopedia on the Internet where everybody contributes information to it, right or wrong. Everybody puts what they know about it, and they correct each other. They can correct false information, and eventually the theory is it's all going to be right information. And so I have a feeling that with so many people out there, there's no reason to have worries about this. Of course, we have things we have to deal with, and that's why we get together every month or so and talk about them, and that's why we keep learning.
Absolutely. You and I are both in an education, and certainly my background also. I taught in the public school system for 5 years and at the University of Houston for a short time. In terms of education, then, which educational resources do you find or do you think are most useful for persons with new low vision diagnoses, or for those persons with a low vision diagnosis to share with family members?
Well, there, of course, the ones I lead people to are the Internet resources, because those are easy to get to. Let me name a few really good websites first. The MD Support, of course. You know, I would like to think mine is one of the most effective ones. MD Research, who is one of our sponsors, has an excellent website on this, and they also help raise funds for research, which we don't, by the way. And so if you want to give, there's a good place to send your money. Also, the MD Foundation, who is our other sponsor, they do both. They put out the research money, and they also put out the information, just like MD Research. We're all partners in this. And speaking of partners, MD Partnership is another organization that's on the net, and they've also tried to reach out into the community just like our sponsors have, and reach people who are not on the internet. They have live information packets. They call them toolkits. And actually, you have some things that I gave you when you first joined the group from MD Partnership, who donated those magnetic Amsler grids and things like that. And so there are groups like that. There's Senior Sight on the American Federation of the Blind. I send people there because they have an excellent site. Lowvision.com has a good site for information and resources, and so does the Foundation Fighting Blindness. Those are probably the top sites. The Lighthouse, of course, has an excellent site. And there's about 25, but those would be the top. Then there's some good books on the market. I'd like to include mine on there as well, called The First Year Age-Related Macular Degeneration. And it's probably the newest one out there, so it's a little more updated than the others. Living Well with Macular Degeneration by Bruce Rosenthal, a friend of mine who's with Lighthouse in New York. That's a good book with some good practical tips in it. Lila Smoke has been our guest. She was our guest last month. Her book on macular degeneration called The Complete Guide to Saving and Maximizing Your Sight. That's an excellent book. I contributed a little bit to that one, and then she contributed to mine, and so we kind of we think everybody ought to just buy our books tied together, and you'll know everything you need to know. Making Life More Livable is another good book by a man from the American Foundation for the Blind. His last name is Duffy. And Solomon, an author named Solomon, wrote a book just on a personal level called Overcoming Macular Degeneration, A Guide to Seeing Beyond the Clouds. All of these are listed on the MD support site, so facilitators, you can go there to the site and go to mdsupport.org/recommend.html, and that's where these books are all listed, if I went a little too fast for you there. And so those resources are outstanding. Those are ones I send people to. Of course, there's informational resources on diseases. And again, on our site, we have a links to all of those resources under diseases.html. That'll give us good information and good updated information about that. So that's where I learn a lot of things that I learn. As of course, I learn a lot from people like Dr. Huggett, who we talk, we share ideas. He buys me dinner. I still owe him one. And that's where we also learn a lot, is just getting to know people. I travel around a lot. 8 to 10 times a year, I'm at some conference somewhere talking to doctors and therapists and that kind of thing. And just knowing the people and getting to know their problems and sharing with them, that's kind of like a support group as well. So that's where all this stuff comes from, Ed.
Yes, wow. Do you have time to sleep there anywhere? That's amazing. I'm glad you talked about your book for a second, because I want to take the liberty here of showing the cover of your book, because you know, it's near and dear to my heart. I'm sure it is, obviously, to you, but for me it was really where we became connected in that way. And I just really enjoyed the how it was laid out, just a person going through the step-by-step process of being diagnosed and dealing with macular degeneration. It's just interesting how you put that together. I'm not really sure how that came about, and really how you keep up with the current research. I know you mentioned you go to meetings and that kind of thing, but you know, I do the same, and I'll tell you what, the volume of information is just tremendous out there. If you were to change your book or add to it, you have anything down the road that you're planning on doing with it?
Essentially just updating it. There's some things that have come out since then, and it's going to go into a third printing here pretty soon, and I'm hoping they're going to ask me to do a second edition where we can do some updating. It's only 2 years old, but so they may wait a while on that. But as far as the basics are there, and those haven't changed. The task force, I talk a lot about that, the fact that we need to build our TASK, which is tenacity and adaptability and support and knowledge. Those are outlined in the book. Our determination to explore these new directions that we have to go with this vision, our adaptability to the changes that we have to make, and where do we find things to help us adapt, our support, as I mentioned, and our knowledge, as I always mention. That task force is probably the essential core of that book, and so that's never going to change. That goes for people with any challenges in their life. If they've got a good task force, they're going to make it through pretty well.
Okay, very, very good. Now, if I know there's a lot of people, obviously many, many more people could benefit by your book. But due to limited funds, they really may not be able to afford it or have some difficulty in terms of obtaining a book. Any specific options that they may have in terms of obtaining the book or the information in your book?
Yeah, there's a real easy way. Everybody listening has one. Their facilitator has one. I gave it to you when you first joined, and so if they've been keeping that a secret, simply go up to them and say, I want to borrow that book. It's in relatively large print, not the largest print. If you can't read the print, then you can get it on, then you should be qualified for the Library of Congress. We have our Talking Books people with us today. And that is available on tape, on audio tape, and that's totally free. You just go to your library or call your library and say, I want the machines and I want Dan's book, and it'll be there. There's also discounts on Amazon.com where they're selling this book used. Many, many different places are selling it now in used form for $6 to $8, and so that's a pretty good deal for a book that's normally $16. So those are three good ways to get that. And or you could come to one of the meetings that I go to and just say, I want a book, because I can't say no to anybody, and so you'll probably end up with a free one anyway.
Spoken like a true teacher and instructor, just ready to pass out and provide information. That's great. Along that same line of thinking, in terms of teaching others, maybe a person with low vision, do you think that simulation of the disease with family members is a helpful strategy to facilitate more support from the family and those around them? What experience have you had with that, and what would you suggest to people in terms of visual simulation of what they're experiencing?
What I do is if I don't have one of those really handy little simulation cards, which, again, I think everybody in every group has one of those, carry that around and simply tell people to put this up to your eye. And if you didn't get those for some reason, please let me know and I'll send you one. These are provided by Envision, one of the sponsors of our activities. And that's a good way, just to have them try to walk around holding that thing against their eye. If you don't have one of those, just you can use words. You can simply say it's like having a spot of Vaseline on the center of your glasses, or you can say hold your fist up in front of your eye about 12 inches from your face with your thumb toward you and your fist doubled, and then stare at your hand and then try to walk around the room. That's what we see, and that's about all we lose, and that's encouraging for a lot of our family members to know that we actually see pretty well. Unless, of course, we have secondary complications like a detached retina from hemorrhaging or something that complicates the problem, then that's really all we're going to lose is about that 35% of the visual field. And so I try to give people some encouragement so that they don't, you know, they're not thinking that I'm going to start running into walls and things, that I can still see to walk around. It's just that they need to realize that I can't see their face, so they need to be aware of that, so that when they walk in a room, they announce who they are. They say, my name is so-and-so, that they don't think you're being rude if you're not looking right at them when you're talking. You can fool people with that, though. You don't have to look at somebody's eyes. We just do that because we can see. But then when we find out we have to see peripherally, we look off-center, and then that can be disconcerting for some people when you're not looking right at them. So the eye contact is kind of important, and I've known some people who are totally blind who still look me right in the eye because they've learned that socially people accept that better, and they've learned the trick. And you can get – the reason we look people in the eyes because we're trying to get visual cues from them as to how they're feeling and are they smiling and that kind of thing. But you can get cues from people other ways. You can get it through the sound of their voice, especially the sound of their voice, and their body posture, which you can see. And so there are ways that we can trick people into thinking that. And once again, I've totally forgotten the question that I started on. Ed knows me pretty well. He knows that I get on a subject and I just decide to go somewhere else. So somewhere in there, Ed, I hope that was an answer.
Okay, absolutely, Dan. You definitely covered it very well. Thanks. I really appreciate your candidness and expanding on those kind of things. And I was wondering, two things came to mind. I know that we teach eccentric viewing, and I know I have rehab therapists that teach eccentric viewing, and that goes with reading and looking at faces and scanning and those kind of things. And I know that people have that eye contact, and it's certainly necessary, but I know that there's probably people, now that we talk about it, that are taught eccentric viewing, are looking off where they need to look, but and know they're not looking at the person they're talking to. I wonder if there's an experience there that needs to be addressed a little bit as far as how that person maybe feels that is doing the eccentric viewing, or the person that is looking at the person doing the eccentric viewing, how they might feel. How do you instruct people to handle a situation like that?
With directness, I simply say, hopefully they understand, and I don't have to say anything. But I will probably bring it up if they don't, and they're a stranger, and I would recommend that a person who views it eccentrically would just bring it up and say, I apologize for not looking you in the face like I should, but I can't see you unless I look off to the side. And that's a chance to educate. And they'll understand that, especially children. I teach children through teenagers, and they're very flexible. They'll say, sure, Dan, go ahead. And that's it. They won't even ask further questions. They just accept it the way it is. And so it's real easy in my profession to handle my own peer groups, because most of them are young enough that they're flexible with that. The older people, there's different ways that you have to address the issue. You've got to come up with ways to let them know, and don't give them too much information at a time either. You don't want to do that. If they come up to you and say, how you doing? Well, tell them, fine, unless, of course, you want to go further into that. And it depends on how they say it. If they say, how you doing, in a nice, cheerful way, then they just really don't know. They don't really want to know how you're doing. They're just asking. It's like, hi. And so they probably don't care to hear much more than that, so I just say fine. On the other hand, if they are sympathetic about it, if they say, how you doing, Dan, then I say, oops, they've heard about this. They know I've got some kind of problem. And that sounds like that they are wanting to know just a little bit more. And again, it's usually enough time for me to just respond with something like, I'm experiencing some vision loss, but I'm doing fine. And that's usually enough right there. If they ask for more information, though, I would offer more detail about MD. That would then lead them to more discussion, because they would almost inevitably, when I mention macular degeneration, they'll almost inevitably tell me that they know someone who has that. And I take that as their way of saying, I understand, or they might be saying, don't feel awkward, you're not the only person I've met with that. Then, if they want to know more, I start educating until I feel like they've heard all they want to hear. And that's a sign of a good teacher, is when to shut up. And so that comes with a little practice. If they start looking away or, you know, that kind of thing, you know they've heard enough. If I feel they want to help the person that they know who has those vision problems, that's when I'll offer them direct them to more information, and I carry a card. And I'll say, here's my card. Here's where you can find the information. You've got to be careful of misunderstandings with people, though. I was teaching people with developmental disabilities at a local college, and the head instructor came in and said, how are you doing today, Dan? And I said, well, I'm losing my vision. I may not be able to continue much longer in teaching this particular subject. And he, of course, said, well, you know, I've had days when I felt that way, too, but I kept going. And he totally misunderstood what I was saying, and it was not his fault. I used the word vision, which can have many meanings. So communicating is tough. And again, that brings up the problem of the eccentric viewing. When you can't see a person's face, you could be misunderstood too. And so you have to be very careful about your selection of words. The person also, this also brings up, a person needs to know that they need to enunciate when they speak to you, if you can't see their face or their lips, because it's amazing how much we actually read lips when we have vision. We get a lot of our understanding from reading lips. And so, for example, the word poor. Now, you probably thought I said poor, or you don't know what I'm saying because you can't see my lips. What I'm really saying is T-H-O-R, which is Thor. And you might have thought I was saying F-O-R because you couldn't see my lips. So we can easily misunderstand if the person doesn't enunciate carefully. That doesn't mean they speak louder. We don't want them to yell at us. Just speak slower and enunciate a little bit more. And I can get away with that because I'm a drama teacher and a speech teacher, so they know, they expect me to say that. And so these things, it just takes communication and understanding and a sense of humor on all sides, and we're all going to be just fine.
Well said, well said. I started thinking about positive outlooks, negative outlooks, and that kind of thing. I'm sure you've come across in all your experiences with people with macular degeneration and vision impairments that you would call maybe a negative thinker. Have you seen the so-called negative thinkers become positive thinkers and come to embrace the challenges after being diagnosed that they have? And if so, how do you think that could be best facilitated?
Well, I am of the mind that some people are negative anyway. Some people are grumpy anyway. They're born that way. And why they're that way, I don't know. It's just that some people handle life that way. So you have to realize, am I talking to a person who is negative because that's the person, or are they negative because of their visual difficulties? And then you first have to sort that out. And if they're just being grumpy, then I use a little tough love on them. First of all, I won't let them use their vision for an excuse. And that's sometimes what they'll try to do. And I've got a couple of stories in my book. My favorite one is the lady who couldn't see in the restaurant. And I said, well, do you have a magnifier? And she said, a lighted magnifier. She was complaining because the lights were too low, which is it's a good point. But I said, don't you have a lighted magnifier or a flashlight? She said, well, yeah, I do. I said, well, doesn't it work? Is it the wrong magnification? She said, no, the batteries are dead. And I said, well, okay, then can you put some new batteries in it? Would you be able to see with it then? She says, I can't get to the store. I said, well, who gave you the magnifier? She said, my daughter. I said, can't your daughter go buy you some batteries? She said, oh, she's too busy. This lady didn't want to help. She just wanted to be grumpy. So, of course, I wasn't going to give up. Because that's the way my grandma was. And so I simply said, well, I tell you what, if I buy you the batteries, will you put them in your magnifier? And she said, yeah, I suppose. I said, then will you be able to see better in the restaurant? And she said, yeah, I suppose. I said, then can they keep the lights nice and soft and romantic for those other people who can see better? She said, yeah, I suppose. So so Mr. Grumpy had no argument. She was just in a bad mood, and she was going to use her vision as a way to get out of it. We have to meet the world halfway. And so sometimes I'm not too sympathetic. I'm always empathetic, but not too sympathetic to somebody who's not trying to meet the world halfway. And I believe that we have to do that. There are ways that we can change. And I know we don't like to change after we hit 60. We think this is the way we're going to be the rest of our life. But we have to make those changes because it's a new situation. We don't suddenly become shorter or suddenly become taller, which could cause us problems, or suddenly, well, lose our hair, which I did. We just put on a hat. You know, those things are easy. Losing our vision is a little more difficult. That's 80% of our sensory input. And when we lose that, we've lost a lot, and that's going to require some heavy changes. And that's why we have professionals like Dr. Huggett who are out there sitting there waiting for us to come to them and ask for help because they've got the help. And so those are the low-vision professionals that we need to hook up with, and there needs to be a lot more of them. So we can do it. We got to, and that's kind of a slogan, meet the world halfway. And I have another slogan that I like, and that's if your cup is half empty, get a smaller cup. Maybe our expectations are too high. Maybe we should lower our expectations. I used to run up the stairs, and I expected to run up the stairs a few years ago, and I realized I couldn't run up the stairs anymore. I just about killed myself, and I said, wait a minute, I used to run up the stairs. So I had to lower my expectations. Okay, I'll take my time going up the stairs. Big deal. So I got a smaller cup, and I'm happy. I still get up the stairs.
Beautiful. Great advice. I do want to ask, in terms of the whole outlook on life and those kind of things, Dan, counseling services, it comes up in my mind quite a bit, and I sometimes still grapple with really when to plug that in. I know that's an important part of treatment, and I have a good friend of mine who I work with in the clinic who's a psychologist who wants to be more involved with my patients with low vision. And I wonder if your experience has shown that it's more important to have counseling services immediately after a vision loss or diagnosis, or do you think waiting a while is better?
When I was first diagnosed, I didn't want counseling. I didn't want to be told I was going to be low vision. I thought I just didn't want to do it. I denied it. And it was later that when I started realizing the need for it, when I started to actually have the problems and have to face the challenges, that's when I realized the need. So we don't want to tell, and I recommend to people who are going into low vision rehabilitation certification, that they just introduce this fact, and the doctors too, introduce the fact that there are things out there, that there is a continuum of care, a road they can follow when they're ready, and that's the key, that's the operative word right there, is ready. They're not going to be ready right off the bat. It's not like you've got cancer, you've got to have rehab, or you've got a broken leg, you've got to have rehab, because that's immediate. You need immediate care for those. With MD especially, it's a long term, 20 years sometimes, to develop full geographic atrophy in the extreme cases. And so they've got time. And that's the important thing. And they don't want to think about it until they actually have the problem. So I don't recommend going right into counseling because or sending grandma into counseling because they're not ready for it and they'll probably just fight you on it. Let them know it's there, though, because that's what identifies the monster. And if they know what it is, then they know when it's time for them to ask for it. And the same thing goes with driving a car, which is a whole other hour of subject that we're going to be talking about in January. A person usually knows when they should give up those keys, and you've got to trust them to make some decisions. Again, it's misunderstanding. Sometimes our kids think we can't see as well as we really do, and the state even allows you to drive the car, especially if you're using bioptic lenses. There are ways that we can actually do that, so don't automatically assume, no more than we should assume, that an 80-year-old should stop driving a car just because they're 80. That age differential doesn't matter. It's how well they can handle their condition. And so these things are gray areas. And so counseling is the same thing. Don't assume that just because a person has been diagnosed with AMD that they immediately are going to be depressed and have to go into counseling. And because if they'd simply had the information in their laps, they're probably not going to go into that depression. They're probably going to feel pretty good about their future, knowing that there are options.
Okay, good. I guess I asked that mainly because I was just curious to how maybe your thoughts may have changed over the years since your first diagnosis. But all right, so the second part of that question might be, how about a psychologist to help with counseling and coping strategies with family members? I'm thinking of Chris and all the people that may be experiencing vision loss and their significant other, their wife, their husband, their children, and so on.
Guilt is the biggest thing with caregivers that I've found. They feel guilty that they can't do anything about it. They also, and I know it sounds strange, but they will also feel guilty because suddenly, or not suddenly, but gradually, they become immune to the fact that their husband or wife or mother has a vision problem, and they don't pay that much attention to it anymore. They go on with their lives while mom still has the problem, and she's living with it every day. And so we have to communicate more. The caregiver realizes that mom has a vision problem, but also knows that there's nothing more that she can do, that he or she, the caregiver, can do about it. And so there's really nothing to say, and so they stop communicating. Mom, on the other hand, doesn't want to burden them, the kids, with that problem, and so she doesn't bring it up. And so there's a wall then between them, which is basically a wall of empathy. It's built up because these people care so much about each other that they're trying to protect one another. And they really shouldn't do that. They need to come up with a signal, some kind of a verbal signal that says, I want to talk about this. Are you ready to talk about it with me? And open those lines of communication. And so that's what my wife and I have done. And every once in a while, she says, I'm so sorry. I feel so bad. I haven't even thought about what you're going through every day. And I don't want her to feel bad. So I say, well, there's nothing to feel bad about. You know, I'm living with it. I'm doing fine. If I had a problem, you'd know it. I would tell you, because I know that my line of communication is open. So I try to absolve her of any guilt she might feel for not being so much a part of it as I am. Did that make any sense there at all?
Absolutely. Great information. I myself, I'm going to go back over this presentation today in the archives when it's available and listen to it. That's a great experience, Dan, and I really, really appreciate that. I want to see if I can type some of this up and share it with some of my patients. Because that's an area that I feel that's just been very, very underutilized in terms of information being passed out to others. And and educating others. I want to take a second and just change from the last few minutes that we have here some other things that's really been on my mind lately. I've had a number of patients that have come to me as new patients lately that have been prescribed or sold devices in the past, closed-circuit TVs or video magnifiers and other things. And I find that they've just been sitting in the corner and, in fact, just basically sold a bill of goods. Any suggestions to our listeners today of how people with vision impairments could avoid being taken by people maybe that are somewhat unethical and out there just to sell products and not really there to help them? What suggestions do you have?
Well, first of all, they should be with a reputable low vision therapist or specialist who knows what they need, who is evaluating them for that purpose, looking at their needs and their goals and designing techniques and devices that person needs to get around. One person may benefit from a cane, mobility instruction. Others maybe don't need it at that point. Another person may benefit from a 10x magnifier, and another one may need a 4x. And they have to be analyzed for that purpose. They've got to be evaluated and given the right equipment in the first place. Now, that means you need a person who is ethical and isn't going to just try to sell you a magnifier. If they have a low vision certification, look into their background just like you would if you were going to buy insurance. You do a little studying, or you look under the car hood before you bought a car. Do the same thing with these people. Anybody can hang out a shingle and say, I'm a low vision specialist, but check it out. And also don't give up. If you're not having success, you should be. You should always be having success. There's always improvement that can be made. There's never a brick wall. There's always another way to solve a problem. So keep trying. Go for second opinions. If you have to, go for third opinions. My final diagnosis was a fourth opinion, and I finally found out what I really had. And so just don't give up, and don't on the first try, and check out your professional that you're dealing with, and check them out thoroughly. That can be done easily on the Internet nowadays, so hopefully you can find somebody that can do that for you if you don't actually have your own Internet access. And I'll bet, Ed, you've got some suggestions on that too.
Oh, absolutely, and really, it's interesting when I think of patients coming into the office. I know they don't even realize that, you know, the years of going to school. I went to college for 10 years after high school to be able to do what I do, and you know, all those years and the financing of the education, everything, all led to the culmination of the point and to the point where I could actually sit in front of a patient and make recommendations. And when you think of it that way, it's the culmination of all that work that led me to that point. So when a patient comes in to me, I'm glad they're there. I'm glad to be able to be there, honored to be there. So I want patients and people with vision impairments to know when they're in the office of a good eye doctor, or ophthalmologist, or optometrist, or in front of a good occupational therapist that works with vision rehab, that person, that professional that's sitting there, went through a lot of work to get to that point, the opportunity and that honor of being in front of that patient to provide services. And that's what gets me up out of bed in the morning, gets me excited to do things like that, and even to be here this afternoon with you, Dan. And if you're not getting a good vibe from your professional, if you're not getting the attention that you need, and certainly not getting the answers that you need from that professional that you're in front of, then don't hesitate. Don't feel bad about it. I think the person needs to walk out the door and then go and research for another professional. So if there is one resource or group you would recommend patients or families to look into, maybe as a clearinghouse, what would that be?
Well, obviously, MD support. We're not the only one, though. The ones I named earlier are excellent organizations to go to, but if we can't find the answer for you, we will help you find the answer. We'll give you an answer. It may be that I don't know the answer. I'll help you find out, but we're not going to let you stop there. And let me just take a minute to, with the last minute we have here, the title of this session was Who Am I and What Am I Doing Here? So those are two questions that we may want answers to, and they're very brief. Who am I? Well, first of all, I'm not my eyes. I'm me. I'm still me. I've always been me, and I always will be me. I may be grumpy, but I'm still me. And if anything, I'm probably stronger because of my eyes. I've developed other senses that are making me stronger and probably better off than most people. I'm certainly more humble and more appreciative of the gifts that I was given in the first place, the gifts of hearing and touch and everything else. And what am I doing here? Well, I'm not here by choice. I certainly didn't ask for it. I didn't plan on it, but some doors opened, and I there's no reason not to go through those doors because it's a lot better than staying in the hallway. We're on a detour here, but sometimes those detours, you get off the main highway, and those detours can be very pretty, and you can pick up a lot of information, a lot of sights along the way, and we're all going to meet at the end. We're all going to end up at the same place, and we're all going to give ourselves a big hug and say, well, that was quite a trip, wasn't it?
Ben, we thank you for today's presentation and the ability to have such a forum like this each month. If anyone has questions not covered in today's presentation, please submit them online at mdsupport.org. And I want to say thanks also go out to Macular Degeneration Foundation at eyesight.org and Macular Degeneration Research at ahaf.org. And I do want to thank everyone here and keep looking up.